Well, good evening. Thank you for coming back tonight. We are in 2 Chronicles chapter 29. We're going to be looking at the life of Hezekiah, looking at some details from Hezekiah's life from 2 Kings, from 2 Chronicles chapter 29, and then from Isaiah. A lot of details there. I'm afraid that we probably won't get any further than Hezekiah tonight. I mean, I hope you're all right with that. I mean, I'm really starting to fall into a comfortable teaching mode here of just slowing way down instead of the survey. I apologize for that, but if you keep coming, I'll keep doing that. I really am excited about getting into the next chapter of the book, of the framework book, chapter 22, where we've got that timeline to follow. We've got to get through King Hezekiah, and then his son Manasseh had a 55-year reign of some great corruptness and wickedness. And yet there's a great story at the end how he repents in a Babylonian prison and comes back and tries to bring revival, kind of sets the stage for his grandson Josiah, another boy king, to become king and work with Jeremiah. And again, we're not going to slow down like we could, because all the way through these verses here, these stories, you can drop in guys like Isaiah, and all of his prophecies take place during either Ahaz's lifetime, Hezekiah's lifetime, Manasseh's lifetime that follow. And so there's so many things you could plug in world situations. And once again, as we begin tonight, the world situations that are supporting the evidence in the scriptures, it just fits like a glove into a hand. No. A hand into a glove. There we go. But it's the names in the Bible match historical dates. They match the reliefs of the palace that are carved in the palace in rocks in Nineveh, in the Assyrian king's palace, all these names, the details, and the events. In fact, go, if you would, please, to page 128 of your framework book, and then we'll head into 2 Chronicles chapter 29. I guess what I'm saying is we're slowing down a little bit, but we could dive just deeper and deeper, because the material is there. From the Assyrians, from the Babylonians, from other writings, it's just so well documented, these stories, and you can get more of a picture of what's going on. But let's take a look at what we have here in page 128 of the framework book. We got a little bit about Hezekiah and what I've got written there. He's going to reign for 25 years. He's going to tear down the high places, the Asherah poles, and crush. In 2 Kings, it mentions, only in 2 Kings, it mentions that while he was tearing down the high places and the Asherah's poles, he also went out and crushed the bronze serpent that Moses had made. Remember the story when they all were afflicted and they had to look out at the bronze snake and they were healed? That bronze snake was crushed. It was still available, still around, even up until Hezekiah's day, but apparently it had become some form of idol worship or something, and he destroyed it. It goes on and says that he's going to celebrate the Passover. We'll read about that a little bit. But on the top of page 129, it says that in 725, here, let's do this real quickly. We're going to get a Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, the Dead Sea. In 725, we lose, in our story now in 2 Chronicles, we lose Samaria, or the Israel in the north. We lose them tonight. Jerusalem, of course, is down here. The Assyrians, this is the Arameans, Aram, and up north, further north, is the Assyrians. They're going to come down in 725 and attack and begin their siege of Samaria. And in 721, they're going to fall. Hezekiah is going to become king with his father. He's working alongside of his father as a co-regent, King Ahaz, in 729. So if in 729, King Hezekiah becomes co-king with his father. 725, the Assyrians come down and begin their siege work on Samaria, and it's going to take about three years, and in the process, in 721, they're actually going to Israel, northern Israel is going to fall. And you see right there the dates. This is going to continue until in 701, Hezekiah is going to have his own invasion, where Sennacherib, the new Assyrian king, is going to come down. He's going to come through the Megiddo Valley. And then there's three ways through the Megiddo Valley to pick up the plain of Sharon over here. This is where the military traveled. This is where the caravans traveled. They come down here, and then they're going to make their move on Jerusalem or Judah. There's a city right here called Lachish that we have got The city is still there. I saw the city. It's a tell. It's a mound yet. But even yet, you can see on the side of the mound, you can see the siege work that was built up by the Assyrians when they destroyed Lachish. They also, if you go and look online, you can find pictures from, again, the palace in Nineveh, the reliefs that they've carved in there. There's room after room after room that they've excavated of these reliefs explaining and detailing the wars that the Assyrian kings fought. In great detail, they record the battle at Lachish. You can see them building the siege ramp and using the siege ramps. They have reliefs of the archers and the slingers with the sling stones in the back shooting as the infantry makes their move. I mean, it's detailed of this fall. So the Bible's going to mention this, and the Assyrians describe it, and Lachish fell. You can go there and see the archaeological remains of it yet. As this goes through, in 701 is when that's going to take place, Jerusalem itself is going to be delivered. Although Sennacherib has no, this is so such a great story in the Bible. It's backed up historically. Sometimes we talk about Egypt and the Exodus. It's like, well, that sounds like a fable. Doesn't sound like it's true. I believe it's true. The Bible believes it too true. But it's kind of hard to find the chariots at the bottom of the Red Sea, although some people think they found them and different things like this. It's kind of hard to prove it. The Egyptians are not going to carve it on their pyramids, you know, that we were destroyed by Jehovah, the God of Israel, and they all ran away. They're not going to record that. And so sometimes it's lost in history, although there's things backing that up also. But if you look on page 129, we're going to get to the story today where Sennacherib, after just plundering, destroying, coming down to Lachish and taking the fortified cities, as the Bible says, he sends a letter that we'll read to the city of Jerusalem and say, why don't you just give up? You can't stop me. No one, don't trust your gods. Everybody else I've conquered has trusted their gods. I am going to come and take your city, but if you will surrender, you can join with me. And the Bible says that he was defeated one night. 185,000 soldiers were killed by the angel of the Lord, came out and killed him. And if you go through the Old Testament theology and you look at it's pretty clear. That is the second member of the Trinity that came and struck them down. We know him as Jesus. The second member of the Trinity came and did that work, the Son of God. Again, we can talk about that when we get into theology. If you look on page 129, right at the bottom of that first paragraph, this event, although it's not recorded by the Assyrians, is recorded by Herodotus, one of the great Greek historians. He lived between 484 and 425 BC. He records this event, but he gives credit to that the Assyrians stopped their siege in Jerusalem or in Judea and return because mice came in and chewed up, and you can see as it says right here, they invaded the camp and gnawed the quivers, the bowstrings, the leather shield handles, and the Assyrians got up one day and they are completely disarmed by the mice. And they fled. Now that's how the Greeks, who aren't even involved in this battle, record this event. Now again, I'm not saying that contradicts the Bible. I'm just saying that the Greeks say that wasn't a normal invasion because Sennacherib left, and he's going to spend the next 20 years. Sennacherib will spend the next 20 years in Assyria. He eventually is going to be killed by two of his sons, slaughtered in the temple where he's worshiping his god. He never wanted to leave Nineveh again. Whatever happened here, the Greeks say it was a strange event. The Assyrians, well, what do they say about it? Well, you've got it right here in the framework book. If you look on there, the second paragraph, the Sennacherib prison, which was discovered in Nineveh, and that you've got a little drawing of it. It's a prism, and all that is writing. That you can see that you can't read it, of course, but that represents writing. It's the cuneiform writing all the way around that prism, and it was discovered in 1830 in Nineveh, the capital. And this is one of three accounts recorded by the Assyrians of their Judean invasion. The Bible records that Isaiah was there in the scene. Hezekiah and Isaiah are facing this. Now this is 180 miles from up here down to Beersheba. It's about, say, 70 miles across here. So you understand, we're not talking about, you know, Russia. We're not talking about the continent of Africa. We're talking about, you know, the southwest counties of Iowa. And, you know, you've got like three counties left, and 15 or 20 counties have been completely destroyed by the Assyrians, and you're still living there in your city with some walls saying, well, we're going to trust God on this one. It's like, there's no way you're going to stop Sennacherib. No one can stop Sennacherib. But yet he gets to Lachish, destroys Lachish, and then something happens. Well, look at right here. On the Sennacherib prism that they found, it says, you've got it written right at the bottom paragraph. This is what it says. In my third campaign, I marched against Hatay Lulai, king of Sidon, whom the terror-inspiring glamour of my lordship had overwhelmed. Now, you can tell this is, you know, he's kind of helped editing it. Had overwhelmed, fled far overseas, and perished. As to Hezekiah, the Jew, he did not submit to my yoke. Now, notice he admits Hezekiah would not submit, which is again, look at the story right here. That's a huge testimony to Hezekiah. I mean, you're the last county standing in southwest Iowa, and you're saying, not on my watch. and Sennacherib, that was kind of a strange. He says, I laid siege to his strong cities, walled forts, and countless small villages. You can imagine what would happen to a small village with no walls, and conquered them by means of well-stamped earth ramps. Like I said, you can see those at Lachish yet, the remains of them, and battering rams brought near the walls with an attack by foot soldiers using mines, breaches, as well as trenches. I drove out 200,000, 150 people, young and old, male and female, horses, mules, donkeys, camels, big and small, cattle beyond counting, and considered them slaves. Himself, Hezekiah, notice what he says. I made a prisoner in Jerusalem his royal residence like a bird in the cage. In other words, he says, I took Hezekiah and I kept him in Jerusalem like a bird in the cage. Yes, and then Uncle Sennacherib, what happened next? Well, I came home. You didn't destroy Jerusalem? No, I had Hezekiah like a bird in the cage. End of story. I just notice in the Assyrian account, they say, we had him pinned in Jerusalem. Hezekiah couldn't even get out. And then what'd you do? Well, he goes on, I surrounded him with earthwork in order to molest those who were coming out of the city gate, thus reduced his country, but I still increased the tribute. He said, I charged him a tribute. The Bible records it also that Hezekiah continued to send tribute after that, but he was never conquered. And so again, the Assyrian account lines up, and you read some more there, lines up with that. A little bit about the Assyrians, so you get an idea of what we're facing or what Hezekiah and Isaiah had to face. We're just reading about it. Here's a quote. I had some pictures I wanted to show you, and I'm not going to be able to show those to you tonight because I couldn't quite get that to work. Fortunately, I got a video to work. I can show you a video at the end. But here's a quote. I had a picture I wanted to show you of right off their reliefs of three guys in chains and a soldier with a spear just poking out one of the guy's eyes, and two of the guys standing in the back had hooks in their jaw, and they're standing like just like dogs on a chain. And again, when we get to next week, we're going to read that the Assyrians come and get Manasseh, put a hook in his jaw, and take him back to Babylon. The Bible says that, and I could have showed you a picture here, maybe I'll show it to you next week, of that very thing of them having hooks in people's jaws, taking them off into captivity. Another thing they would do, the Assyrians, well, let me read this quote to you, and I'll tell you about it. This is a quote from one of their reliefs there in Nineveh. It says, describing their battle, their men, young and old, I took as prisoners. Now, this isn't in your book. I'm reading this off my notes. There are men, young and old, I took as prisoners. Of some, I cut off their feet and hands. Of others, I cut off their noses, ears, and lips. Of young men's ears, I made a heap. Of old men's heads, I built a minaret. And there are, in the reliefs, the pictures, there are, what they would do, they'd take posts or sticks, and they just run skulls down on top. So when you'd enter a city or walk by a city that had been overrun by the Assyrians, it was kind of like a warning. You don't want to mess with us because here's their city elders. You can see them, they're all stacked up here on poles. Their heads just stacked up. You'd walk between the pillars of skulls. They would have people impaled. They didn't crucify yet. Romans kind of came up with crucifixion. They kind of refined the process. But they would impale people. They got pictures of just a stick with a human body just hanging on it. They just hang up, and they just line the roads with human bodies and skulls. They were vicious. Notice they're cutting off ears, making a pile of ears. What we got over here? We're collecting ears over here. And a pile. You imagine how many people? You did not want to be conquered by the Assyrians. It was a terrible. And Isaiah and Hezekiah are facing these guys right here at Lachish. I mean, they're 20 miles away. And they're standing at your city gate tonight. We're going to read it. They're standing at their city gate reading you a letter saying, why don't you just give up? Well, that's some information there as we go now to, please, 2 Chronicles chapter 29. Now, we're heading there tonight. 2 Chronicles chapter 29, I believe we started with this last week. And, Tony, I'm missing an eraser, if you could help me with an eraser. I think I might have one in my bag over here. Chapter 29, Hezekiah becomes king. Now remember, he became king after his wicked father Ahaz. Ahaz had led people astray, but for some reason, he'd been co-king with him for a few years. You see, from 729 until I think it was, oh, he became king officially in, thank you so much, Tony. Give my wife a round of applause, please. He became king in 715 is his official time. He became king 715. So he'd been between like 729 and 715, he'd been reigning as a co-regent with his father Ahaz. So he'd had some experience. But it says in chapter 29, verse 1, I think we read this last week, in verse 3, in the first month of the first year of his reign, he opened the doors of the temple of the Lord and repaired them. He brought in the priests and Levites, assembled them in the square of the east side, and said, listen to me, Levites. He's telling them, listen to me. And notice what he says, consecrate yourself now and consecrate the temple of the Lord, the God of your fathers. Remove all the defilement. In other words, the first thing he does after his father dies is, well, let's get this thing back on track. He goes in, he begins to clean the temple out. He brings the Levites in and says, you get ready. Consecrate yourself. That means they've got to do certain rituals, certain procedures to get ready to serve in the temple of the Lord. Just the Levites and priests could serve, of course, you know that. But they had to serve after having gone through certain requirements. If they were just of the family of Aaron, they couldn't serve. You had to be in a certain condition as far as your clothing and your washing and all your rituals and all your eating. And he says, consecrate yourself. Now, we read this, I think, last week about how they had to go through, they began to clean the temple out. And we looked over here in verse 16 of chapter 29. Let's go verse 17. They began consecration the first day of the first month, and by the eighth day of the month, they'd reached the portico of the Lord. It took them 8 days just to get to the stairway of the temple, of the building itself. For eight more days, they consecrated the temple of the Lord itself, finishing on the 16th day. And so then they had to clean the temple out. And again, when you think about the temple, you think about a massive, huge, you know, production. It was a beautiful temple. Solomon had built it. A lot of, you know, decorations and buildings and how you'd have, you know, the pillars. But the actual size of the temple, I mean, it's not, you know, it's like this room. I mean, imagine 8 days cleaning this room out, and this is the national effort to clean this room out. It took them 8 days to get to the temple and then 8 days to clean it. Well, verse 20, early the next morning, King Hezekiah gathered the city officials together, went up to the temple of the Lord, and they began to bring sacrifices. And I think we talked about all the offerings that they're bringing here a little bit last week. Offered burnt offerings and everything, thousands of bulls and all that they're doing. But the thing that you're going to notice in verse 34, jumping all the way down to the end, he had called the priest to get serious. And the priest, apparently, it's going to be mentioned 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times in chapter 29 and chapter 30, where it's going to say the priests, they hadn't got themselves consecrated. Look at this right here. Verse 33, the animals consecrated sacrifice amounted to 600 bulls and 3,000 sheep and goats. The priests, however, were too few to skin all the burnt offerings. And again, there's all these animals were coming in. And I can't remember, did we talk about this last week at all? Okay, so I'm repeating myself. Okay. So again, they didn't have enough people to do all this work. Again, you're going to have rows of cattle, bulls that you're slaughtering. It's going to be it's a lot of work. You can't just have two or three people doing it. But the priests hadn't got themselves ready. In chapter 30, it says it again in verse 34. For the Levites had been more conscientious in consecrating themselves than the priests had been, so the Levites had to step up and help out because the priests hadn't taken it serious, apparently. Chapter 30, Hezekiah sent word to all Israel and to Judah and also wrote letters to Ephraim and Manasseh inviting them to come to the temple of the Lord. Now remember, Israel fell in 721. This is now 715. Israel has been overrun by the Assyrians now for the last 6 years. And so now what he's going to do, he's going to send an invite up to all these cities. Okay, here we go. Jerusalem. And all these people here, he's going to invite northern Israel to come back down and join them at the temple, get them back on track. It says here, he invited Ephraim and Manasseh, inviting them to come to the temple of the Lord to celebrate the Passover. Verse 2, the king and his officials and the whole assembly in Jerusalem decided to celebrate the Passover in the second month. Now realize you're supposed to celebrate it in the first month. They had not been able to celebrate it at their regular time because not enough priests had consecrated themselves. In other words, he says, let's get this thing going. Consecrate yourselves, Levites, priests, let's get this going. They didn't, and they're dragging their feet. He brings in a bunch of sacrifices. People respond. The priests can't worship. They can't serve because they didn't get ready. And now he invites all these people down, but he says, we got to wait a month because my priests aren't ready.
So they had to wait for the priest again to get ready. Notice what's happening. You've got the king wanting change. You've got the people wanting change or willing to respond. But yet the priests are like, they're not taking it serious. Verse 5, they decided to send a proclamation throughout Israel from Beersheba to Dan. Beersheba down here. Dan is the northern place up here. That's supposed to be about 180 miles apart. Calling the people to come to Jerusalem and celebrate the Passover of the Lord. It had not been celebrated in large numbers according to what was written. It had been years since they'd actually done it. Solomon was probably the last one to do it full scale. And it's going to mention that later. At the king's command, couriers went throughout Israel and Judah and letters from the king and his officials, which read. Did I read this to you last week? Okay, I'm sorry. See, I'm teaching this in Audubon also, and so I get confused. I look out at you and I think, you know, either I haven't told you and I think, well, you must know this. But anyway, let me read the letter. Notice this letter again, please. People of Israel, return to the Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, that he may return to you. You've got to come so he can respond to you. Who are left, who have not had, okay. That he may return to you who are left, who have escaped from the hand of the kings of Assyria. He's talking to the people up north. Do not be like your fathers and brothers who were unfaithful to the Lord, the God of your fathers, so that he made them an object of horror as you see. Do not be stiff-necked as your fathers were. Submit to the Lord. Come to the sanctuary which he has consecrated forever. You know, come to Jerusalem, come to the temple. This is where he's going to be. We've got the truth here that can help you. Serve the Lord your God that his fierce anger will turn away from you. If you return to the Lord, then your brothers and your children will be shown compassion by their captors. Interesting. And will come back to this land. Notice the promise he puts in there. He says your families have been taken captive. 6 years ago, they're completely exiled, taken out of the land. But if you will return to the Lord, your captors, their attitude will change towards your family, and they will be brought back. Interesting. Now, that never happened. For the Lord your God is gracious and compassionate. Again, God has judged us, but we can call to him if we want to, if we will respond. He will not turn his face from you if you return to him. Now, there's a good guarantee. Even in judgment, God will come to you. We saw it in David's life. Well, going on. Verse 10. Well, what did they say? The couriers went from town to town in Ephraim and Manasseh as far as Zebulun. Again, Zebulun's one of the northern tribes up in here. Ephraim, Manasseh. Go through this whole land. These are messengers that were sent out and invited in. You know the parable that Jesus tells, you know, about how he invited the people to come and they were busy, they didn't come. He's not necessarily referring to this, but it's a similar thing. Come, and they wouldn't come. Well, watch, here's what they say. But the people scorned and ridiculed them. Can you imagine? Your country has fallen. But that's how the Baal worship and the false ideologies have was so deep in them that they would not even respond to this invitation. Nevertheless, some men of Asher, Manasseh, and Zebulun did humble themselves and went to Jerusalem. Also in Judah, the hand of God was on the people to give them unity of mind. Now that's a good thing right there. Unity of mind to carry out what the king and his officials had ordered following the word. Verse 13, what happens? A very large crowd of people assembled in Jerusalem to celebrate the Feast of Unleavened Bread in the second month. They removed the altars in Jerusalem and cleared away the incense altars and threw them into the Kidron Valley. Again, that's on the east side of Jerusalem. They slaughtered the Passover lamb on the 14th day of the second month. That's supposed to be the 14th day of the first month. The priests and the Levites were ashamed. Why? And consecrated themselves and brought burnt offerings to the temple of the Lord. In other words, the people are coming, but the priests and Levites are ashamed and they bring offerings. Now you understand what that means? The people are showing up. They respond to this invitation. Judah's responding. People are coming down from the northern tribes. And the priest, it says they offered sacrifices. Those sacrifices, it says they brought burnt offerings to the temple. Those are offerings to consecrate themselves. The people are standing in line. It's like, oh, just a minute. I can't do yours until I've done mine. And then that's like now the fourth time we've read that. When are they going to take Hezekiah serious? Then they took up their regular positions as prescribed by the law of Moses. They got themselves consecrated. They take up their positions. And you probably got to understand they probably had to do some study, figure out what their positions are. The priests sprinkled the blood handed to them by the Levites. Since many in the crowd had not consecrated themselves, the Levites had to kill the Passover lambs for those who were not ceremonially clean and could not consecrate the lambs themselves. In other words, the people coming out of Israel here, and this is interesting, they've been in Baal worship for 200 years, and now they're going to come to Jerusalem. Do you expect, and here's a little lesson, do you expect them to act Jewish?
I mean, do you think they know the law of Moses? We're going to find here in a couple weeks, hopefully in a week, Josiah is going to find, when he cleans the temple, he's going to find the book of the law. And he's going to, or the priest is going to bring it to Josiah and says, look what we found. We found the law. We found the Bible. It's not like everybody had one. They just had one copy. We found it. He goes, well, let's read it. And they read it and go, oh, we're in trouble. Meaning, these people are trying to follow God, and a lot of the times they're just running on memory from what their grandfather had told them that they're supposed to be doing. And if you've been in Israel for 200 years, that whole thing's been wiped out. They haven't been teaching that at all. Now, you understand there's the applications are very, very steep. It's hard to have revival in Israel because they don't know where to revive to. They come down and they say, okay, we will. But even in coming, they're doing it wrong. Imagine, how can America even repent? How can America even have revival? It's like, what are we reviving? Where are we even going? Let's turn and follow God. Where? Who is he? What is the character of God? And so it's kind of a scary position. When you lose that knowledge, the more you lose, the harder it is to recover. Well, here we go. They came down, and it says in verse 18, although most of the many people who came to Ephraim, Manasseh, and Issachar, from Issachar and Zebulun had not purified themselves, yet they ate the Passover contrary to what was written. Now, if you look down in verse 20, what the result of that was, they got sick. Judgment came on them. These laws that God has given Israel, he expects them to follow. And if they don't follow it, you think you're getting blessed, you're coming under God's judgment or discipline. And so these people apparently are sick. Something's happening. And here it goes. Hezekiah prayed for them, saying, may the Lord, who is good, pardon anyone who sets his heart on seeking God, the Lord, the God of his fathers, even if he is not clean according to the rules of the sanctuary. So Hezekiah goes and prays the prayer. He prays the prayer basically, listen, let's take what we got. These people are turning back towards you. They have no idea what you expect. Let's just give them some time. Let them come in, and then we can start teaching them and take this judgment off of them. And it says, and the Lord heard Hezekiah and healed the people. Verse 21, the Israelites who were present at Jerusalem celebrated the Feast of Unleavened Bread for 7 days with great rejoicing, while the Levites and priests sang the Lord every day, accompanied by the Lord's instruments and praise. Hezekiah spoke encouraging to all the Levites who showed good understanding of their service. Now here's a compliment. Notice this right here. Hezekiah spoke encouragingly to the Levites who showed good understanding of the service of the Lord. You know, a few weeks ago, they weren't even consecrated. They didn't even understand what they were supposed to be doing. And now it seems like they're bringing things together. And he compliments them, says, nice job, we're doing a good thing. Verse 23, the whole assembly then agreed to celebrate the festival for 7 more days. So for another 7 days they celebrated. Hezekiah, the king of Judah, provided 1,000 bulls and 7,000 sheep. This is amazing. You see this? 1,000 bulls. Did we read this last week? Okay, this is 1,000 bulls. Hezekiah says, well, everybody showed up. We got 1,000 bulls over here. Grab one. And he also provided 7,000 sheep and goats for the assembly. Now, they're going to kill all these animals. They're going to butcher all these animals. They're going to bleed the blood out of all these animals. They're going to try and eat all these animals. I mean, they don't just burn them. They eat them. It's part of the routine is they eat part of the animal. It's like, it's unbelievable. 1,000 bulls. How many priests do you need to offer 1,000 bulls? And the people are, these are like major, these are the most expensive offerings you've got in Israel, is a bull. Well, go on, look at this. Not to be outdone, it says, and the officials provided them 1,000 bulls and 10,000 sheep and goats. So Hezekiah provided 1,000 by himself and then 7,000 sheep and goats, but his officials, those helping him, his cabinet, his officials that work in the government with him, they provided another 1,000, and then what does it say, 10,000 sheep and goats. And they're all, and they're for, like, apparently for public use. It's like, you haven't got a sacrifice? Go grab a bull. There's like 1,000 left. And they're bringing in, moo, moo, whatever a bull says, and they slaughter them. A great number of priests consecrated themselves. What? The priests are still consecrating themselves. I mean, that was the first thing he told them to do in chapter 29, the first day, consecrate yourself. And there's still some people dragging their feet until they see 2,000 bulls lined up. It's like, well, I better go to work. And then they've got to go through the consecration. Verse 25, the entire assembly of Judah rejoiced along with the priests and Levites and all who had assembled from Israel, including the aliens who had come from Israel and those who had lived in Judah. There was great joy in Jerusalem, for since the days of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, there had been nothing like this in Jerusalem. The priests and Levites stood
to bless the people, and God heard them, for their prayer reached heaven, his holy dwelling. And that's a great story right there of revival coming to the land. You got the priests on board now. The people are there. Israel's starting to trickle in. Verse 30, chapter 31, when all this had ended, the Israelites who were there went out to the towns of Judah and smashed the sacred stones and cut down the Asherah poles. After this revival, they go, let's go out and clean the land. And again, we still have evidence of this in different places of this being done. They destroyed the high places and the altars throughout Judah, Benjamin, and in Ephraim and Manasseh. They've even crossed the border into Israel and are taking down the altars there. After they had destroyed all of them, the Israelites returned to their own towns and to their own property. This next part, chapter 31, we could continue reading it, but I want to move on. This is basically about what happens right here is the contributions of the people bringing the contributions. Of course, they hadn't been bringing all of the money they're supposed to be bringing in, and hadn't been all the food. The priests lived and Levites lived off the provisions that the people would bring these sacrifices. It talks about how they started bringing these things in, and there was so much, and eventually it gives you names of people that were organizing the distribution. Some of the people were on staff, on the priestly staff, to simply organize the distribution of the things that were coming in. And that's the way it was supposed to be. Verse 16 of that chapter. In addition, they distributed to the males 3 years old or more, whose names were in the genealogical records, all who would enter the temple of the Lord to perform the daily duties, their various tasks, according to their responsibilities and divisions. In other words, if they had a genealogical record tying back to Aaron or the Levite, tribe of Levi, and they were 3 years old or older, they fell under the part of receiving part of the contribution to help take care of them, because they're supposed to be doing what? Not just sitting home eating like Eli's sons were corrupt. Remember that story? They just sat around and ate and barbecued all the food. They were supposed to be provided for, because the Levites and priests were supposed to be doing these things. This was key to the nation. This was important. Well, it goes on, and it finishes that chapter up. Verse 20, it says, this is what Hezekiah did throughout Judah, doing what was good and right and faithful before the Lord his God. In everything that he undertook in the service of God's temple and in obedience to the law and commands, he sought his God and worked wholeheartedly, and so he prospered. Again, that's not the prosperity message there. That's the owner's manual message. If you take care of the car is going to last and run a long time. If you start doing strange stuff to your car, running it the wrong way, you're going to destroy your car. That's what that's saying. If you live the way you're supposed to live, these things, it all fits together. And so his kingdom, he himself, began to prosper because they're walking in the wisdom of God. Now, chapter 32 begins right here. After all that Hezekiah had so faithfully done, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and invaded Judah. Now, there's a classic example of someone doing the right thing and bad things happening to him. And it goes on and talks about that here. I want to now, this time, go over, please, to the book of Isaiah, because I think Isaiah is going to give us the same story. Many of the things you can see that they're probably copied from the same source, or they're being using the same material. But Isaiah is going to give us more information. Isaiah, up until this time, if you just a little bit on the book of Isaiah, is up through chapter 35 is probably material that was written during the early days of Hezekiah's reign or Ahaz's reign. Chapter 36, 37, 38, 39 is this account right here of 701 B.C. 701, when Sennacherib comes down to Lachish and is coming up for Jerusalem. And that is that part. Then what takes place after chapter 40 to the end of the book is things that probably took place later in Isaiah's life and details that he wrote about. And you even see a break as far as direction in the book and the focus on the book. But I do have online Isaiah, verse-by-verse teaching through Isaiah. It's a great study if you want to listen to Isaiah being taught verse-by-verse. But that is online. I don't know how many CDs it is. I don't know, messages, 40, 50. Sinai, do you even know? 50, yeah. It took us a year or so, at least a year. But that's online if you really want to listen to Isaiah verse by verse being taught. You do. You really do. It's interesting. And if you really want some, I can burn some CDs for you, I suppose. Okay, is there? Okay. There's one set of Isaiah left. Part two. You don't even want it. Where does it start? What chapter does it start with? Chapter 47. Okay. You know what that Isaiah series was? That was originally an Old Testament survey. It really was. The first two CDs are like Old Testament survey through Isaiah. We're covering a lot of chapters, then we just, wow. Okay. we're not going to do that. Well, we are. Chapter 36 of Isaiah. In the 14th year of King Hezekiah's reign, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, attacked all the fortified cities of Judah and captured them. Isaiah chapter 36. Then the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, sent his field commander with a large army from Lachish. Why is he sent him from Lachish? Because that's their base of operation. To King Hezekiah at Jerusalem, with the commander, when the commander stopped at the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the watchman's field, Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, the palace administrator, Shebna, the secretary, and Joah, son of Asaph, the recorder, went out to him. So here's some of the officials. You've got to assume that some of these three guys were part of that group that brought the 1,000 bulls along with Hezekiah's 1,000 bulls to the sacrifice. So these guys they're lined up with Hezekiah. And here's what the field commander says to them. Tell Hezekiah, now we've got the letter right here, and I'm going to read it to you if you don't mind. This is what the great king, the king of Assyria, says. On what are you basing this confidence of yours? Why haven't you surrendered? Why are you not paying your tribute? Why are you standing against Sennacherib? You say you have strategy and military strength, but you speak only empty words. On whom are you depending? You can just break this down point by point. They've got a strategy. They're telling their people, we've got a strategy. Now remember, he's reading this letter to them in front of the wall. The people have crowded up over the wall. They're looking down. It's not just talking in a private meeting with closed doors. This is him in the country. He's on television. He's on CNN. He's on Fox News addressing the public. And they can't shut him off. In fact, they're going to say, please, don't speak Hebrew. Speak a different language to us. So we know what you're saying. We don't want the people to hear what you're saying. He goes, I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to your people so they know how you're deceiving them. So the first thing he says, they tell you they've got strategy and military strength, but they speak only empty words. On whom are you depending that you rebel against me? Look now, you are depending on Egypt, that splintered reed of a staff which pierces a man's hand and wounds him if he leans on it. Such is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who depend on him. And if you say to me, we're depending on the Lord our God. And you notice the word Lord is all capital letters, meaning we're depending on Yahweh our God. Isn't he the one whose high places and altars Hezekiah removed? Hezekiah did. Because they had Yahweh centers all around, place to worship Yahweh, but they're not supposed to have. Remember, those are the home Bible studies without a Bible. And they're worshiping Yahweh, but they're not really worshiping Yahweh. And Hezekiah went down and tore them all down. And so the media covered it as this. You know, Hezekiah's tearing down churches. Well, he's not tearing down churches. He's tearing down churches that are corrupt. Now, I'm not promoting that. I'm just saying that's what Hezekiah was doing. When we are depending on the Lord God, isn't he the one whose high place and altars Hezekiah removed, saying to Judah and Jerusalem, you must worship before this altar. You must worship here in Jerusalem at the temple. And that was originally from the law of Moses. Come now, make a bargain with my master, the king of Assyria. I will give you 2,000 horses if you can put riders on them. In other words, listen, let's forget this whole thing. You give us 2,000 of your soldiers, we'll give them horses and they can join our military. Do you even have 2,000 soldiers? Do you even have 2,000 military men? In other words, I doubt you can even give us 2,000 men. And then you're trusting these 2,000 that you don't even have. How then can you repulse one officer of the least of my master's officials, even though you are depending on Egypt for chariots and horsemen? Furthermore, I have come to attack and destroy this land. Oh, excuse me. Furthermore, have I come to attack and destroy this land without the Lord? The Lord himself told me to march against this country and destroy it. Then Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah said to the field commander, please, please speak to your servants in Aramaic, since we understand it. Don't speak to us in Hebrew in the hearing of all the people on the wall, please. People are understanding what you're saying. You're upsetting our community. But the commander replied, Was it only to your master and you that my master sent me to say these things, and not to these men sitting on the wall who, like you, I'm sorry, this is a terrible verse. I'll just let you read it here. Read that right there. He says, these men, this is what a siege would end up like. There's no food. And the only food, we talked about it before, when the birds would fly over Samaria, they'd eat the bird dung. They'd sell the bird dung for gold or silver. And, you know, the fluids, the drink, it says there's no fluids. Well, now you can read that right there. He says, this is what we're going to do to your city. You either send us 2,000 men and surrender, or this is where you're going to end up. Then the commander stood and called out in Hebrew, "Hear the words of the great king of Assyria. This is what the king says. Do not let Hezekiah declare to you, deceive you. He cannot deliver you. Do not let Hezekiah persuade you to trust in the Lord when he says, 'The Lord will surely deliver us.' This city will not be given into the hand. This city will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria." Don't let him tell you it won't happen. "Do not listen to Hezekiah. This is what the king of Assyria says. Make peace with me and come out to me. Then every one of you will eat from his own vine and fig tree and drink water from his own cistern." There's the promise. You surrender to me, it's going to be a chicken in every pot. That doesn't sound familiar. "Until I come and take you to the land like your own." Until I come and take you to a land like your own. Well, we're still going to deport you. I'll give you your own vine, your own cistern in the land of my choosing, because we're going to deport you. "A land of grain and new wine and a land of bread and vineyards." It will be a beautiful place. Sure it will. "Do not let Hezekiah mislead you when he says, 'The Lord will deliver us.' Has the God of any nation ever delivered his land from the hand of the king of Assyria?" He says, so far, no God has been able to stop us. Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Those would be up in north in Aram. Where are the gods of, again, some other names, they're up north. Have they come to rescue Samaria?" These are just the cities they've walked through. Where are their gods? "Who of all the gods of these countries has been able to save his land from me? How then can the Lord deliver Jerusalem from my hand?" But the people remained silent and said nothing in reply because the king had commanded, "Do not answer him." Then Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, the palace administrator, Shebna, the secretary, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder, went to Hezekiah with their clothes torn and told him what the field commander had said. Now remember, this is the book of Isaiah. This is Isaiah's writing. This is recorded in 2 Kings and recorded in 2 Chronicles. Verse 37, "When King Hezekiah heard this, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and went up to the temple of the Lord. He sent Eliakim, the palace administrator, Shebna as the secretary, all wearing sackcloth," guess where? "To the prophet Isaiah." He says, "Isaiah, we have a situation. I'll meet you in the situation room." They told him, this is what Hezekiah says, "This day is a day of great distress and rebuke and disgrace, as when children come to the point of birth and there's no strength to deliver them." In other words, he says, we've got the temple working. We've got the priesthood back in operation. The people have sought their God, and we are now at the point of deliverance, of birth. He says, but do we have the strength to see this thing through? "It may be that the Lord your God will hear the words of the field commander whom his master, the king of Assyria, has sent to ridicule the living God, and that he'll rebuke him for his words the Lord your God has heard. Therefore, pray for the remnant that still survives." Again, remember, Lachish is gone. The citizens of Lachish have been, there's reliefs in Nineveh of the citizens of Lachish being deported. Some of them are hanging on poles. Some of them are stacked with their heads cut off. But some of them are just walking off. They're just being deported to somewhere, a land of the king's choosing. And this is all that's left is Jerusalem. I'll say this again. Israel has been conquered. The fortified cities of Judah have been taken, including Lachish, one of the key cities, one of the great fortifications right there. This city of Jerusalem is surrounded by the Assyrians. There's no hope. There is no hope. There's nothing inside these walls. If they attack us, we'll shoot them with these arrows. It's like they probably have fewer arrows than the Assyrians have men. Meaning, when the Assyrians would march, history records that the ground would shake and it'd be like a storm because of the dust. It's just moving through. And you took every arrow and shot at every Assyrian, there'd still be Assyrians coming. There was no way, no way, no way. Verse 5, when King Hezekiah's officials came to Isaiah, Isaiah said to them, "Tell your master," here's Isaiah's words, "tell your master, this is what the Lord says. Do not be afraid of what you have heard. Those words with which the underlings of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me, listen. I'm going to put a spirit in him so that when he hears a certain report, he will return to his own country, and there I will have him cut down with the sword." When the field commander heard that the king of Assyria had left Achish, he withdrew and found the king fighting against Libna. So again, Libna is, even Lachish is here. And when the field commander comes back, says, "Okay, I've done my job. Well, where's the army?" "We're done here. We've moved on to Libna. Libna would be closer." So then the field commander comes back up there. In other words, they're moving in. Now Sennacherib received a report from the Cushite king of Egypt that was marching out to fight against him. When he heard it, he sent messengers to Hezekiah with the word, "Say to Hezekiah, king of Judah, do not let the God you depend on deceive you." And there's more reports right there. Now here's Hezekiah's prayer, verse 14. Hezekiah received the letter from the messengers and read it. He reads the letter. He actually got a copy. Then he went up to the temple of the Lord, look at this, and spread it out before the Lord. Hezekiah gets that letter, a hard copy, a printed copy of the speech given to this people at the wall. He takes this and takes it to the temple and says, "God, did you read this? Have you seen that? If you didn't hear it, I got you a copy." And he lays it in front of the God in the temple. And he prays, "O Lord, Almighty God of Israel, enthroned between the cherubim, you alone are God over all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. Give ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see. Listen to all the words Sennacherib has sent to insult the living God." Now, again, Hezekiah is praying right here because he has no other option except to surrender. I mean, that's not the reason he's praying, but I mean, this is not like before I go to battle, I'm going to pray. This is, I'm not going to battle. I'm pinned up in here like a bird in a cage. The next thing I do is, like he said, you know, he'll have his ears cut off and piled up. His head will be posted somewhere. And it could be a miserable next few months. I mean, beyond miserable. I mean, unbelievably not livable. Verse 18. "It is true, O Lord, that the Assyrian kings have laid waste to all these people and their lands." It's true. They're powerful. "They have thrown their gods into the fire and destroyed them. And they were not gods, but only wood and stone fashioned by human hands. Now, O Lord, our God, deliver us from the hand so that all kingdoms on earth may know that you alone, O Lord, are God." Then Isaiah, son of Amos, sent a message to Hezekiah. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. "Because you have prayed to me concerning Sennacherib, king of Assyria, this is the word the Lord has spoken against him." Now, we read Sennacherib's letter. Let's read God's letter. It's a little longer and a little more sarcastic. Are you with me yet? Here's God's response. We read Sennacherib's letter. Now, how would the Lord respond to that kind of an insult? "The virgin daughter of Zion despises and mocks you. The daughter of Jerusalem tosses her head as you flee." Now, he's not saying I'm doing this. He says, my city that you've insulted is throwing their head back and giggling like a little girl as you run away. "Who is it that you have insulted and blasphemed? Against whom have you raised your voice? Do you know who you're insulting? And lifted your eyes in pride? Against the Holy One of Israel. By your messengers you have heaped insults on the Lord. And you have said, with my many chariots I have ascended the heights of the mountains, the utmost heights of Lebanon. I've cut down all the tallest cedars, the choice of the pines. I've reached the remotest heights and the finest of the forest. I've dug wells in the foreign lands. I've drunk the water there, and the soles of my feet I have dried up all the streams of Egypt. Oh, you've done all these great things. Have you not heard? Long ago I ordained it." In other words, the only reason you even left your land, the only reason you weren't destroyed by the plagues or the Scythians back in Jonah's day was I sent Jonah to you and told you to repent because I wasn't done with you. He says the only reason you're even breathing is because I said you could. "In days of old I planned it. Now I have brought it to pass. You've arrived on history. You've conquered the lands I wanted you to conquer. That you have turned fortified cities into piles of stone. Their peoples drained of power are dismayed and are put to shame." And again, he gives them all credit. He says, yes, indeed, you've got a trail of disaster. People are terrified when you come. But he's saying, do you know why they're terrified? Because I let you do it. I'm the one who said go do it. He says, and now you're mocking me? You go through and destroy all these lands? And he turns and says, I'm going to get the Lord too. It's like, well, wait a minute. Your power is me. You can't use me against me. You've just cut yourself off from the source. Verse 28. He says, but I know where you stay, and when you come and go, I'm watching you, and how you rage against me, because you rage against me, and because of your insolence has reached my ears. I will put a hook in your nose, and my bit in your mouth. Again, what he's saying right here, these are the things the Assyrians do. He says, I'm going to put a ring in your nose. I'm going to take you where I want to go. I will make you return by the way you came. Just as you came down here, I'm going to put a hook in your arm and drag you right back up to Assyria. You don't talk to me that way. And this will be the sign for you, O Hezekiah. This year, now then again, this is what God told Isaiah, and this is God's letter back to Sennacherib. And then Isaiah says, this is a sign. Remember, whenever God gives a word, he'll give a sign to say, these aren't just empty words. Watch, let me show you something funny, something amazing, something strange. There's something strange going to happen. And this is the sign. You understand what I'm saying? Even when the angel came and told the sign is in the manger, you know, the baby in the manger, that was a sign. There always are signs. Watch. This is Hezekiah's sign. This year, you will eat what grows by itself, and the second year, from what springs from it. But in the third year, sow and reap, plant vineyards and eat their fruit. Once more, a remnant of the house of Judah will take root below and bear fruit above. He says, here's your sign, Hezekiah. This year and next year, you're just going to have to survive on what's out in the land because there's no time to plant anything. But in that third year, you'll know. Because within 3 years, within 36 months, your economy is going to be turned around. You're going to be having vineyards. You're going to be back on track. 36 months and this economy will be turned around is what he's telling him. For out of Jerusalem will come a remnant, from out of Mount Zion a band of survivors. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. Therefore, this is what the Lord Almighty says concerning the king of Assyria. He will not enter this city or shoot even an arrow here. The only thing he's going to do is read you a letter. He will not come before it with shield or build a siege ramp against it. By the way that he came, he will return. He will not enter the city, declares the Lord. I will defend the city and save it for my sake and for the sake of David my servant. Verse 36, then the angel of the Lord, again, that is the second member of the Trinity. Then the angel of the Lord went out and put to death 185,000 men in the Assyrian camp. When the people got up the next morning, there were all the dead bodies. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, broke camp and withdrew. He returned to Nineveh and stayed there. Verse 38, this is 20 years later historically. Isaiah records this, but this happened 1 year before Isaiah was martyred, apparently. It fits in with the time scale. One day, while he was worshiping in the temple of his god, Nisroch, his sons, Adrammelech and Sharezer, cut him down with the sword, and they escaped to the land of Ararat. They ran north. And Esarhaddon, that's his son, succeeded him as king. Esarhaddon at that time was on a military campaign when his two brothers cut down his father. Esarhaddon then inherits the throne. Let's go back to, stay right there. If you may want to mark that. What time is it going to be? Okay. Go back to 2 Chronicles, please. 2 Chronicles. We may come back there. There's three or four more stories about Hezekiah that we could look at here, and I'd like to. 2 Chronicles chapter 31. 32 is Sennacherib's invasion. I just want to read the rest of chapter 32 here. We should go back and read. We got other things happening here with Isaiah. But I just want to read the end right here, kind of a summary in 2 Chronicles chapter 32, beginning in verse 24. Now let's begin in chapter 32, verse 20, okay? Chapter 32 of 2 Chronicles, verse 20. King Hezekiah and the prophet Isaiah, son of Amos, cried out in prayer to heaven about this, about Sennacherib. And the Lord sent an angel who annihilated all the fighting men and all the leaders and officers in the camp of the Assyrian king. So he withdrew to his own land in disgrace. And again, remember, in disgrace. Remember the world picture. The world doesn't go, oh man, who can fight against the Lord? The angel of the Lord came and killed all of his men. That's not what the newspaper said in the morning. The newspaper says 185,000 soldiers lost, Sennacherib retreats. I mean, it's like, yeah, but did you know what happened? And the angel of the Lord came and killed. It's like, we don't want any excuses. You're retreating, aren't you? I sure am. I'm not coming back. Well, that's what they're reporting. They're reporting the news. They just see Sennacherib, a failure. He looked, had so much promise, and all of a sudden, boom, he's gone. He's fled back to Assyria. And so what it says, so he withdrew to his own land in disgrace. It's like, but does anybody understand? Nobody's listening. You're running in disgrace. And when he went into the temple of his God, some of his sons cut him down with a sword. Again, that'd be 20 years later. So the indication there is, remember, his son Esarhaddon was off fighting a battle 20 years later. But where was Sennacherib? I'm not leaving the temple.
I'll stay right here in the temple. And one of the reasons they would have killed him was, one, they were jealous of his son Esarhaddon, is one of his sons, but also their dad wasn't doing anything. He's just in the temple. Dad, you got religious all of a sudden. Aren't we going to go out and conquer anybody? No, I'm not going out there again. I saw some things that I don't want to see again. I'm just going to stay right here. And they eventually killed him. So the Lord saved Hezekiah and the people of Jerusalem from the hand of Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, and from the hand of all others. He took care of them on every side. Now watch this. Just like Sennacherib's fleeing in disgrace, back in Jerusalem, guess who defeated Sennacherib? Isaiah, is he gone? Yeah, he's gone. I win? You win. Yeah! Ha ha! And the newspaper says what? Hezekiah defeats Sennacherib. Thank you very much. And so, I mean, it's not like he's going to get into pride, obviously. I mean, who's not? But it's like, he's just the world pressure. It's like, and people are going to come from Babylon. How did you do that? What was your strategy? Well, I'll tell you what I did. And he begins to explain. I don't know. But watch this right here. Verse 23. Many brought offerings to Jerusalem for the Lord. Of course, that'd be people from Judah, thanking God for their deliverance. And valuable gifts for Hezekiah the king. Why? Because it was his brilliant plan that worked. Well, what was his plan? We're going to pray. We're going to seek God. From then on, he was highly regarded by all the nations. We'd like to have Hezekiah speak to our military. Hezekiah now is going to make his presentation and shows how he defeated Sennacherib. I mean, he's sought after. The nations want to hear, how did you do this? No one could stop Sennacherib. And then in one night, you turn him back. Well, we prayed. You know, if you're talking to the military, you're going to have something a little bit deeper than we prayed. But okay, we go read on. In those days, Hezekiah became ill and was at the point of death. He prayed to the Lord, who answered him and gave him a miraculous sign. We can read more about this in Isaiah. But Hezekiah's heart was proud, and he did not respond to the kindness shown him. Again, poor guy. I mean, this guy is serious about following God. But I mean, you know, we're all judgmental. I'll be judgmental of Hezekiah. But what would happen if all of a sudden I was a national hero? I mean, tomorrow morning's paper, you know, whatever. What would happen to me? And I had unlimited resources. Now, I would probably be fine because I've got Tony would keep me balanced. But it's like, but you understand, if any, none of us, I don't know all of your stories, but it's like none of us have, I found Osama bin Laden. I captured him. He's hiding in my creek behind my house. I brought him in. Galen Weavers captures Osama bin Laden or whatever. It's like, what would happen if we did something very heroic? That's not even heroic. That's just, you know, weird example. But nonetheless. Verse 25, but Hezekiah's heart was proud, and he did not respond to the kindness shown him. Therefore the Lord's wrath was on him and on Judah and Jerusalem. Then Hezekiah repented of the pride of his heart. Again, some of the kings never did that. And again, we all are on that roller coaster, following God, you know, and going back and forth. As he did, and then Hezekiah repented of the pride of his heart, as did the people of Jerusalem. Therefore the Lord's wrath did not come upon them during the days of Hezekiah. Hezekiah had very great riches and honor, and he made treasuries for all of the silver and gold and for all the precious stones. Now, this is things that happened after the Sennacherib thing. So they had that moment with Sennacherib, and then they got back on track. Talk about stones and spices and shields and all kinds of valuables. He also made buildings to store the harvest of the grain, the new wine and oil, just like Isaiah had said. And he made stalls for various kinds of cattle. And pens for flocks. He built villages and acquired great numbers of flocks and herds, for God had given him very great riches. It was Hezekiah. This is what I'd like to end with right here. It was Hezekiah who blocked the upper outlet of the Gihon spring and channeled the water down to the west side of the city of David. He succeeded in everything he undertook. But when the envoys were sent to by the rulers of Babylon to ask about the miraculous sign that had occurred in the land, which probably was the destruction of Sennacherib, God left him to test to know what was everything that was in his heart, and other events in Hezekiah's life are written down there. Notice who writes them down. Verse 32, the other events of Hezekiah's reign and his acts of devotion are written in the visions of the prophet Isaiah. And we went over there and read some of those. Son of Amos, in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. Hezekiah rests with his fathers and, of course, was buried on the hill where all the kings are buried. I'd like to have you take your framework book now, please, and go to the back. Well, let's say, I'm not sure where you're at in your framework book. Let's go to page 132. I was going to show you some slides here, some pictures. What time is it now, Tony? Is it like 7 o'clock? 8:03, okay. On page 132, there's two places this is recorded. 2 Chronicles 32, we just read that. And 2 Kings chapter 20, verse 20. It talks about him on the east side of the city of David. Again, here's the original city of David. They built up onto here, onto the Temple Mount up here on Mount Moriah. They extended the city up here. Here's the Kidron Valley, Hinnom Valley coming down around here. Right in here is the Gihon Springs. There's still the remains of four towers that would guard this water. This is the source of the reason the city even is survivable in the days of the Jebusites. It's still there today. Is water is here. What Hezekiah did is, we'll look at the maps here a little bit. When Israel fell in 721, during this time, northern Israel, a bunch of people came down, and they built the city out over this way. They extended the city over to this side to make room for all the people. And this side, I guess we should bring this down further. The people needed water over here, and this is hills, and, you know, it'd take them all day to walk or get water, all day to walk back. Hezekiah is going to dig a tunnel underneath the city of David, underneath in the bedrock, in rock. They're going to chip through it. They're going to start on this side, and they're going to start chipping with picks. And they're going to dig their way, and they're going to meet. And it's not a straight shot. It's still an engineering wonder of how they actually did it, because you can move through it, it meanders, and then all of a sudden it meets. Some would think, and again, they're trying to come up with theories on how they did this. They think that they're up on top, possibly on top in the upper city, with tappers, you know, tapping, and they can hear pop, pop, pop. They can hear the sound as they're picking, and they'd follow the sound. When I walked through Hezekiah's tunnel when I was there, and you can see on page 132, that's me in Hezekiah's tunnel. And as you're walking, there'll be like a little, like you get right over here, and all of a sudden it'd head off this way. Sometimes just like two or three steps. Sometimes it'd be quite a ways, and they'd be like, oh, I think we missed it. They have to back up. And they're chipping rocks. I mean, if you missed it by 3 or 4 feet, it'd be like, it's Wednesday, and we wasted all week. We got to come back over here. And remember, there's not like a lot of people down there. I mean, how many people can be swinging a pick? Look at how much room it is. Some places it's lower than 5 feet and this wide. And it's not like we got like, you know, 50 guys down there. And then you got all those rocks. People are carrying rock out continuously. But anyway, they got this done. On page 133, you can see Hezekiah's, that's a diagram of the city of David. And you can see the tunnel, how it kind of meanders through there, over to the Pool of Siloam. Over here, and you heard Jesus talked about it, or in Jesus' life, he sent a man down there to wash the Pool of Siloam. And this would be a major public bath right here. And the temple's right here. And there was a road that they've excavated it that would go straight up. You know, I don't know if it was straight, but it was a major paved road that people from the temple, they'd wash here and they could go right up to the temple. There's also all kinds of mikvahs for washing up in here too. But the Pool of Siloam right there. Go to the very back page, please, of the book. Or the one of the back maps right there. And look on page 534. And you can see on page 534. Great. You can see on page 534, you see the original city of David and the Temple Mount. And then on page 535, you can see how the city expanded even to include Mount Zion there. And is this playing yet? I'm not sure if this is going to work or not. It was working earlier. I haven't really figured this all out yet. There we go. Just had to hit it. I'll put this book back here. I don't know if you guys want to watch this. If it gets boring, you can leave. This water flowed to the west side of the city, growing city Pool of Siloam, okay? Is this running? And prepared Jerusalem for the Assyrian coming invasion in 701 BC. Water flowing in the tunnel floor. That's a page. I'm not sure if we can see that. Can we shut the other light off too, Tony? That's the Pool of Siloam. The construction is recorded in 2 Kings. We just read that. Galen will walk you from the Gihon Springs under the city. There it is. Galen Weimer's generation word. It's not real clear, is it? I'm standing on the Temple Mound, right below the Temple Mound, looking down on the old city of David. That's Mount Zion to the west there. That's the Jewish Temple Mound. That's the Dome of the Rock right there. So I'm kind of standing right there between, to the north, the Temple Mound, and to the south, the city of David. Now we're going down to the Gihon Springs. I had a Jewish site take this video and put it on their school. They said, we got to take all the Christian stuff out of it. They said, you understand. They said, we want to use this for our Jewish education site. And this is the hole that goes up to the city where Joab would have crawled up to take the city. Now we're walking, we're going through the tunnel here. We're coming down to the Gihon Springs. We're coming out. We're going to come out on the Kidron Valley side. So you see, that's the valley, the Kidron Valley, where the water source is at, the Gihon Springs. And what you see down here, they've just begun excavating. They've found the remains of those four towers that guarded. And that would be that ladder. There, see those four towers? That's the city of David, four towers in the Kidron Valley. The water source is right there. There's one of those towers remaining right now. And there's one of the front towers that remains. Again, these is not real clear. There is a picture that I took a picture of right there. That's the guy that was walking us through right there. Dr. Carl Rasmussen did the tour for us. We were there with him for 3 weeks. He's written the best book. Zonovan published it on the land of Israel, as far as an atlas, I guess you'd call it. He's been in Israel since 1967. Okay. Now we're entering. We're in Hezekiah's tunnel now. That's a light flashing off the water. You're going to see the water here in a little bit. These are a few pictures. I'm excited. There's water right there. This is 3 football fields long, like 1,700 feet long. And the picture, you can see the pick mark. You can kind of see it there, but the pictures are a little bit better, you know. There's no lights out. I just got a flashlight. Oh, that's the only light down there. And you see the water? That's the water on the floor there. That's the left wall, the right wall. And that water is still flowing. I mean, it's the same. It's the Gihon Springs. It's flowed since the days of the Jebusites. That's me. I want to get on the camera here. We're kind of crouching down to get through it. There's water coming in from the ceiling. Got kind of scared. Maybe it's going to cave in on us. Right there, the pick marks, there's a place where the pick marks switch directions. You can see how they're going from different places, and they meet right there in the middle. Okay, now we're coming out right here. We're exiting Hezekiah's tunnel. What we're going to walk into right here is just another waterway, which if you got a Bible dictionary at home and you look up Hezekiah's or Pool of Siloam, they're going to say that's the Pool of Siloam because everybody thought it was the Pool of Siloam. We're going to see it here in just a minute. But in 2007, 2005, I think it was, they were doing some work and they dug up the actual Pool of Siloam, completely different. And you can see, you'll be able to see right here the waterway that everybody thought was the Pool of Siloam, fairly small. When you see it, it looks like a waterway, especially when you see the real Pool of Siloam right here. So here we go. We're coming out of Hezekiah's tunnel now. into what we used to think was the Pool of Siloam right here. That's all water. See, it looks like a waterway, doesn't it? Water, that actually led down to the Pool of Siloam, but that was all the further it went. That's me standing in what everybody thought was the Pool of Siloam. I'm going to try and move this forward. Now here is the excavation. Now you'll see a little bit of the actual pool that has just been discovered. And in the steps, it's like it's steps going step down into the water all the way around. And then there's holes to set like those pots that they'd carry on their heads. You can see where those holes are to set pots, and you'll see that here real quick. We're about done. Just about it. These pictures. That's water flowing. That's the pool. See, it's still being excavated. It's somebody's backyard. The pool's on this side. That's what it would look like. We've only got half of it excavated. You can see these are the steps on the left side, but that's someone's backyard. They haven't dug it out yet. And these are holes we're cut. There's a hole in the rocks and different places to hold the water jugs like this. When Jesus sent the man down to wash his face or the eyes, this is the pool he would have sent him to. It was a busy place. And you see, they got water now on the east side, but now it's because of Hezekiah's tunnel, they've got water now on the west side also. Okay, thank you so much. Just to end that right there, I continue to follow the water through that Pool of Siloam, and then we leave that place and we walk down into the Hinnom Valley, you know, and head back up north to Mount Zion. The water continued to flow under a road. And then there was a gutter, just a drain, just like a city gate, and it was just going down the drain. There's litter inside. It's like you got this whole process, and it goes all the way through the city of David, and it just goes right down a drain. It's kind of unique. Well, hey, I appreciate you being here. I hope you learned something or enjoyed something. I'm going to pray, and then you'll be dismissed, and I just really invite you to come back again, and it will get better, I hope. Okay. Father, we thank you so much for your truth. We thank you for your word. We ask that we may have confidence in you, as Hezekiah and Isaiah did, that we'd have confidence in your word. We do thank you again for your truth and ask that you to be with these people and reward them for the time they've invested in your word. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Hey, thank you for coming.